.409, and the on-base percentage .527. First pitch swinging, and he crushes it. Deep left center field. It's hit a mile. Guerrero with a home run, his third on the season, and the Blue Jays are within two.
Well, that was pretty much the highlight. Mr. Barker, Toronto Blue Jays losing 7-5 to my Kansas City Royals. First of four games from Kauffman Stadium. Not really my Kansas City Royals. I was in on them early. Give me credit for that. I was in on them early.
I wasn't really paying attention if you were. Sorry.
I'm just kidding. The second game of the...
Go, Rays, go!
Oh, stop it. The second game of the four-game series goes tonight.
He is the best.
He is... Well, I'm the best, but Chase is a pretty close second. Game two of the four-game series goes tonight at 8 o'clock on Sportsnet 590 The Fan and Sportsnet. Well, let's deal with the injuries first of all. Jordan Romano, the latest add to the injured list with ulnar neuritis. Doesn't sound good.
No.
Ulnar neuritis. Five syllables. One of Blair's unwritten rules. The more syllables, the worse the injury.
Yeah.
There you go. Think about it.
That's a great point.
Yeah. The more syllables, the worse the injury.
Yeah, make you scratch your head, make you wonder, right? All these things happening. Make you wonder.
I thought that's this complex was going to...
Spend a lot of money on it.
Anyhow, we don't know because... Look, I mean, I don't know.
We're not there.
There's a lot of injuries right now at the Blue Jays. Anthony Kay was called up to make the start yesterday. You made an interesting point as we were talking. I think we both agree Anthony Kay could be a pretty decent pitcher. I don't know if Anthony Kay is good enough right now to do what he was asked to do last night.
I don't think so either.
And explain that, because that's not a criticism, I don't think, of Anthony Kay.
I think he has to have consistent routines. I think he has to have consistent work with Pete Walker, the pitching coach. Yeah, I think he's got to know his role quite a bit ahead of time. You know, there's no 2 days before you know.
Which is not odd.
I'm flying in. Where am I going? You know, what room am I staying in? You know, when am I throwing my extra little what I have to throw? I just don't know if he's good enough. You know, the fastball command, he said in his Zoom call that his changeup wasn't working. You know, what did he give up? He gave up six hits. Four of those were extra base hits. That's three doubles and a triple. Three of the extra base hits were off his fastball. You know, you can throw 95, which when he throws 95, it's good when it's in. And when he misses, it's in off the plate to the righty. But when he's missing on the plate, 95 is not a trick anymore. You're not. If you're a hitter, you're not surprised at that anymore. You see that so much now as a hitter. They're like, how hard does he throw? Does it really matter? Let's think about what he throws his secondary pitches. How much does it break? Where does it start? Is it a big break? Is it 12-6? Does it have more of that 1-7 break? You know, if you're a right-handed hitter and you're facing a right-handed pitcher, does he throw a slider? Does he throw a breaking ball? You know, where do I set my sights? Am I trying to hit it to right center? Am I trying to pull this? You're more worried about secondary pitches than you are worried about how hard a guy is throwing. So, yeah, you know, it's a little unfair. It's sort of like people playing out of positions. You know, Kevin Biggio. Yeah.
Well, there's speaking of injuries. Kevin Biggio left the game after taking a ball off his hand. What was he trying to do?
No idea. Trying to catch it with two hands, which
a
is
a liner. It wasn't a line.
A little bit of the time, so when you're playing third base and sometimes you're playing first base, the ball tends to have a tail away from you. Mm-hmm. Sometimes you got a tendency you want to throw both hands up and catch it with both hands, because a lot of times you catch that closer to your palm and not in the webbing of the glove. And when you catch it in the palm, it has a tendency to want to pop out. So you want to catch it with sort of both hands and wrap your throwing hand around the way you want to catch it. Those are plays just because you're not comfortable playing.
I was going to ask you, someone who's played every day at third base, do they try to make that play?
No, they catch it one hand and it's called. The 99.9% of halfway decent third basemen, that's an out. You know, what's the first thing that I saw yesterday is his pre-pitch setup was very flat-footed. Yeah, the infield, especially when you're playing corners, there almost has to be that internal clock of, okay, I'm on the mound with the guy. I'm gonna start my little – it's going to be very hard for me to explain this, and maybe I'll try and do this on an Instagram hit. it's very hard to watch a guy pitching on the mound and you being at your position. So imagine that you're Kevin Biggio and you're actually going through a windup with the pitcher. When his front foot lands, you want to almost be getting to your, whether it's a hop, whether you're getting wider, but it's that when the ball's crossing, getting to the dirt, you know, it's the, mm-hmm. it's the leaves from the mound. It's the dirt, it's the grass, and it gets back to the dirt. About the time of the dirt is when your feet should be landing in an athletic position where you're not standing still for a longer period of time. Right. And yesterday is, or last night's, you could tell even when they would pan the camera over, obviously we're not there and you can't see every single time he goes into his pre-pitch setup. But the times that you do and the times that he wasn't making a play like a runner on third base, you got to be ready when that ball's crossing the plate because you got a guy at the plate that can hit. And Soler hits the ball hard. I think it was Soler, whoever it was, is a right-hander who hit the ball hard. Hit it too. You got to be a little bit better with your feet to make your hands a little bit softer.
Mm-hmm.
That's the whole point in that, where you can react quicker. Like, you know, it's second nature now that because my feet are working so good, everything else is just sort of going to fall in place because of that reason. And it gets back to that point of how much can we actually expect from Kevin look-wise, athletic-wise. You know, you're asking him to be an everyday second baseman. You're asking him to be an everyday second baseman and run out to left field and run out to right field and run out to center and stand. And now all of a sudden the next year you're asking him in the offseason, go learn how to be an everyday third baseman. I think maybe you could be asking a little bit too much. And now you're starting to look at your defense and you're going, okay, you got a shortstop who may not be an everyday shortstop. Marcus Semien, look, he's going to make routine plays probably that he should be making. Vladdy looks like he keeps raking. He's going to turn out to be the above average first baseman. You know, he's not going to hurt your team.
Mm-hmm.
Now you're looking at your catcher who, you know, couldn't hit water if he fell out of a boat. You got your third baseman who's trying to learn how to play a new position and who all of a sudden now can't hit the way we were seeing.
Right.
Now if you're running this team, what are you thinking? That's the question you got to ask yourself.
Short term, if Kevin Biggio's out, Santiago Espinal has to be called up.
Or Joe Panic, too, right? He can play a little bit.
But you'd have to, if you want to call somebody up, you would probably put Espinal.
I think he's the best defender they got in the infield.
Especially now that Josh Palacios is here. So you've got that second left-hand. If it's an issue, you got that second left-handed back. Quite frankly, I think I'd almost rather have Josh Palacios' bat in the lineup right now than Kevin Biggio's. I don't know how you feel about it.
Yeah, and it's a tough sell, too, hitting Kevin in the five spot. I get it with the people that are out, and they're trying to put, you know, their better hitters up front, and maybe Kevin's earned the right to hit, you know, top five in the order. I don't think so, but, you know, this is one of those things where you hope that George Springer can hurry, you know, Teoscar Hernandez. Right. Obviously, that has nothing to do with Teoscar. But you hope they hurry up and get back in the lineup and start to get longer. And you can put people in the spots that they're supposed to be in.
I think you got it right, though. I think when this lineup is, when everybody's here, I think that Kevin probably hits down lower in the order. You know, what is his strength is his eye. And if you do hit him ninth.
Yeah.
At least it might contribute to turning the order over. To Springer and Semien.
Let me give you just a little bit of stats. I don't want to overwhelm people with stats, but Kevin Biggio's swing percentage is up 7% from last year. His first pitch swing percentage is up almost 5%.
But that was one of the things they talked about with him in spring training. In fairness, in defense of Kevin Biggio, one of the things he's heard is don't always go to the plate thinking you're going to see nine pitches every at bat. Sometimes
the flip side of that is he capable of doing that? Well, stat-wise, right now, we'll tell you in the way he's looking, he's not capable. And the most important one for me is his chase percentage is 25%. That's almost doubled from last year. Last year it was 13.7%. So he is, if he's swinging early, is he swinging at a pitch that he can drive? You just don't want a guy, Jeff, you don't want a guy to go up there and be passive and just to go up to put the ball in play.
Right.
No. I want you to go up. What's Kevin's zone? Probably middle and down. If it's not middle and down, I'm taking that. Oh, okay, two strikes. Guess what? Get in line with the people that don't know how to hit with two strikes. Just that's the baseball, and the pitchers here are really good, mm-hmm. right? They would rather you're looking at that Barlow guy last night that threw the last pitch. He throws more slider percentage than four seam percentage. You know why he does that? He'd rather punch you out, yep. and he doesn't care if he walks you. That's the mentality. Starters are thinking that now. Reliever, middle relief guys are thinking that now, and especially your high leverage relievers are coming in. Jordan Romano is a prime example of that. What's he do? He does it, and he does it a lot. It's flip the slider. I got a slow one, and I got one I can put you away with, and I'm just going to use my fastball for show to set up my more sliders. This is what people are thinking. So there's one thing of just saying I'm going to go up and be more aggressive. You got to be aggressive on something that you can drive. I can do damage on. If I can't do that, if I don't like the ball middle of the way and up a little, why am I swinging at it?
No, that's
makes
great.
No sense. It's okay to be 0-1 on a pitch that's a pitcher's pitch to you. So there's a little bit different with that, and how much that chase percentage thing has to do with. He does know last year, and obviously he's done some work on this with his two-strike approach. They hit around .140 last year with two strikes. Maybe that gets to your point about swinging often and early and not wanting to get to two strikes, and it may have something to do with the third base play.
Well, can I'm also going to – I'll ask you this. Baseball players always say I'm the same person regardless of where I'm hitting.
That's not true.
Of course it's not. But you know, guys say that. I'm the same person regardless
that's
of where
I'm hitting. That's not true. Sounds good.
Do you think moving Cavio – do you think moving Cavio – Jesus. Sounds like an Italian porn star, Cavio. Do you think that I'm sorry, or a model. Do you think that putting Cavan in the fifth spot is a way of affecting or a way of trying to create a mindset?
You've been around baseball forever.
Well, not
forever. Who do you usually put in the number five spot in your order? Run producers.
Yeah.
Is Kevin Biggio a run producer?
No.
So why you put him there? I just don't. That's my point. Is I'd rather put a struggling Rowdy Tellez there. At least Rowdy can hit a homer.
Well, I wonder too.
That's all. I don't get it.
I wonder too if Teoscar's absence doesn't have something to do with that.
These are not perfect scenarios, but you don't punish one guy because the other guys are having the issues that they're having. That's all.
590-590 is the text line if you want to reach out to us. Bill Shaken of the LA Times will join us in a few minutes. Big series this weekend. Padres, Dodgers. Fernando Tatis Jr. will be in the lineup for the Padres. We're also going to talk about Fernando Mania. 40 years ago, Fernando Valenzuela is a big thing. There are kids out here right now who do not remember how big Fernando Valenzuela
was. I faced
him. Mike Petrello of MLB.com. I'll let you tell that story in a minute. Yeah. Mike Petrello of MLB.com has a terrific article on Fernando Valenzuela's impact on attendance. Fernando Valenzuela, I'm going to tell you this. There are a lot of guys who get their due in Major League Baseball. Fernando Valenzuela made a crap load of people a crap load of money. People, I always talk about Roy Halladay and how important he was to the Blue Jays and everything.
Sure.
But Roy Halladay didn't attract more people to the ballpark. Fernando Valenzuela did. You wanted to go to see Fernando Valenzuela pitch.
Probably just wind up had a lot to do with it. It's different. It looked different. You know, I played.
Do you want to tell the story when Shane? Well, tell the story now about your experience against Fernando Valenzuela.
When I was in Mexico, and you know, I can't remember when this is. Obviously, a long time ago, and he was at the end. Like,
he's in his 40s.
Who knows
50s.
How old it was, but he was really way up there. And you know, he had a lot of people walking around with him, making sure he was safe and all these kind of things. And then, you know, he walked.
Do you have any security?
Absolutely zero. And thank you. When he walked to the mound, I thought the same thing that you're thinking. I was like, when we showed up at the ballpark, I was wondering, why are all these people here?
Mm-hmm.
Nobody comes to these games. Well, why is everybody so packed?
Yeah.
I was like, why, what's going on here? And then the guy comes running out and they were playing this music and it was getting all fired up. And then I saw him throw his first pitch and I'm not kidding. Like, I don't want to be mean or nothing, but it was topping out at about 55.
I was going to say, was it 50 poo miles an hour?
It was, you know, he would do the leg kick and the looking at the sky and And I'm thinking, I'm sitting over there going, well, I'm squeezing that. You could see sawdust coming out of my van. I was like, I can get this. Like, you know, it's 50. I can, it's like sort of like soft toss a little bit. But it was, it, you know, I hit a couple balls hard off him.
You hit two home runs
off
him.
But it was just the thing. It's to your point. The place was just, it was crazy there.
Like, he was loved.
And it was just, he had so much fun and he was, he knew. Like, yeah. He didn't have, obviously, his stuff, but he knew who he was and what he was there for. And it was just so much fun to be on the same field with him and seeing all the guys that I were playing with that were from Mexico that were just in awe of who was standing on the mound. Like, they had no idea where they were at. They were so excited. And just to watch him walk out to the mound and do his thing, it was pretty cool. You know, it wasn't to watch him actually pitch because his stuff had went way south, but to actually see the windup up close and see the sky looking and to actually get to walk up and face him was a pretty cool experience.
I want to talk about Danny Jansen too, but I want to ask you this. Okay, so you see the guy wind up. That's the first time you've seen him pitch in person, I presume.
It was, yeah. Okay. I've seen him on TV. But
what do you look at when you're a hitter and you got a guy doing – and this could go – kids may want to hear about this. This can go to any pitcher. You got a guy with all arms and legs and he's looking up, or you got somebody who turns their back to you. What as a hitter do you look at? Like, what does your eye zero in on? Is it release point or what are you trying to pick up?
Well, you really try and do that, right? But it was more for him. It was more, I was trying to follow his eyes a little bit because it's an odd thing. It's not something you usually see a guy take his eye off his target and you wonder how he can do that and consistently be really good at it. And that gets back to the point I've always made. You have to have an at bat on the on deck circle. And that's what I try to do. You know, I wasn't always great at it, but that's what I tried to do to make myself a better hitter and a better player was watch how he's throwing to the guy in front of you. Watch how it looks. Watch where he's releasing it from. You know, actually have your – I can remember seeing Jose Bautista when you would take a pitcher, I think it was Josh Donaldson, mm-hmm. from the side, and Jose would be standing behind him, and he would actually be going through his motion of – you know, he would get it going and he would raise his leg and his foot would land in an athletic position and he would actually take his swing and it would almost look like Josh Donaldson's.
Right.
That's a big league player having a big league at bat on the on deck circle. So I would try to do that. And again, it was a little bit easier because it was in the 50s.
Pete in Hanover says Barker would not need security.
I mean, well, you know, it was nobody cared about me being there. So it was more of, you know, man, you be smart. You don't go out in the dark.
I don't know, man.
You do.
I remember going to covering the Dominican Winter League. 590 is the text line, by the way. Going down to cover the Dominican Winter League. And I remember walking into the Escajito clubhouse and the gun locker.
It's amazing.
And
it is amazing.
Every player. I tell a story about Juan Bell. For whatever reason, I covered Juan Bell with the Expos. For whatever reason, Juan Bell liked me. I have no idea. I may have talked to him a couple of times.
Yeah.
But so I'm walking in the clubhouse, right? And this is, and he comes in and he sees me and he, big smile. The Dominican guys liked it when a North American writer would go down, you know,
sure.
That was,
oh, yeah.
You're coming to, finally, you're coming to see what
there
my life is like.
That's
so
it.
He goes over and gives me a hug and I could feel this thing against
the jacket.
Yeah, and I stepped back and he just laughed. It was a gun. No, it was a gun. He had a gun.
Yeah, the bulletproof jacket was a big deal, especially guys that mattered.
Yes.
You know, I think David Ortiz would wear one of those and
Jesus.
The couple of times that I've seen. So it's an interesting place.
He doesn't need a bulletproof jacket, but what does Danny Jansen need right now? Because, look, Bark, we love Danny Jansen. He's on the show all the time. I've said there's nobody in this organization I would rather see have a great season. But, man, what is he hitting against lefties?
103 in his career.
Okay.
It's not the greatest thing. Not my immediate answer would be send him down. And then I start thinking about who the number one starter is for the Blue Jays and who could if Kirk could catch him.
Not happening.
And the answer to that would be probably no, so that's not an option. But for me, he's not playing 4 days a week.
Wow.
Sorry. I'm sorry. It's just, this is a performance driven league. I'm with you. He's one of the nicest humans on the planet. And this show roots for him till no end. But bottom line is not getting it done. And it's non-competitive at bats. Like he is an easy out. So you can keep running him out there or you can say what's best for the team. Does Kirk give our team a better chance to score more runs?
Do you think he does?
I do.
Okay.
Right now,
okay.
With the options that they have, Danny Jansen gives you nothing. What's he give you?
I can't argue. I mean, I'd like to, but
I hit 240 and got sent to AAA. He's hitting .83, Jeff. He hit a .183 last year.
Yeah, if I could, I would defend him.
Okay, 2019 when he got called up, he hit .207 with 13 homers and 43 RBIs. You take that.
Sure. Oh,
that'd
hell
be
yeah.
Okay. But he ain't anywhere close to that now. Like you can handle, you can okay with the .207 if you're driving, if you're hitting some homers.
Yeah, for my catcher and you're playing and you're giving me good defense and decent defense and my ace loves working with you, I'll take that. I'll take, especially in this team. Well, I can win without my catcher hitting .290.
The first and third at bat last night did it for me.
Yeah.
Three or four non-competitive swings. I'm sorry. This is a performance-driven league. It's just been that way since it's been Major League Baseball. Like, you just can't keep rolling out a guy who's not hitting 100.
I got to ask you this. Do you think maybe he's a backup catcher? Like, that's, you know, and what I mean by that is a guy who's capable of playing twice a week compared to being your five or seven guy?
I say this all the time. Bench players have to be able to hit velocity.
Okay.
What
You're
would
right.
tell you that Danny Jansen can hit velocity?
Fair point.
Until he shows you that he can do that, you know, get the head out. Like, just, okay, I don't like curveball, and you can get me out of the curveball. Okay, I'll tip my hat to you. But if you throw me 94 or 5 right down the middle, I'm going to hammer that thing. It might be an out, but I'm going to hammer it somewhere. When do you see Danny Jansen do that?
Bill Shaken of the LA Times will join us. We're going to talk Dodgers. We're going to talk the Dodgers are 11-2. Shocking. Talk about the Dodgers, the Padres, and we're going to take a little look at Fernando Mania. This is Baseball Central on Sportsnet 590, The Fan. All right, welcome back to Baseball Central, Jeff Blair and Kevin Barker. Well, it's always good to be joined by Bill Shaken, the LA Times, because there's always something interesting to talk about, it seems, with the Dodgers. And, of course, ahead of the series against the Padres, that's one thing. But you also want to talk to Bill about Fernando Mania, Fernando Valenzuela in particular. Bill, thank you for joining Kevin and myself. Well, this is a series I think a lot of people looked ahead to when the Major League schedule came out. It's, you know, it's always going to be a significant series. I think the Fernando Tatis Jr. injury and his return probably makes it even more intriguing. But the Dodgers, I mean, I'll just ask you, they're the defending World Series champions. I get that. And that would suggest they're a good team. But are they really this good?
Well, they're on pace to win 137 games, which would shatter the major league record. So probably not quite this good, but probably also pretty close. They've built for the last 8 years as division champions, a mantra of depth almost as much as talent. And, you know, for example, you get guy like Kike Hernandez, an integral player here for the Dodgers for several years, and they just say, well, let him go because we got a former 33rd round draft pick named Zach McKinstry to replace him as a utility guy, and he's now in the top 15 in OPS in the National League. They just keep churning out the talent.
Okay, how has Trevor Bauer handled the ball issue? You know, I know a couple of balls have been sent to Major League Baseball, you know, he's voiced his opinion on social media, which is what Trevor does. But have you noticed any, you know, I don't know, tension around the team about that? Because there's a lot of things come with Trevor. Has it been okay because of his performance? And maybe the Dodgers just don't care if he keeps performing. Is that how it is?
Well, that's true for pretty much everybody in the game, not just Trevor. There are a lot of players who, you know, you hit 300 or 30 home runs and you're quirky and eccentric, and hit 200 or 10 home runs and you're a distraction and you're sent to the minor league.
Yeah.
You know, everybody knows what the deal is when you get Trevor Bauer and a large outsized social media presence as part of it. And so when this report came out the other night in The Athletic about baseball scrutinizing some of the the baseballs he had used to pitch. Some players would shrug it off or not say anything. And obviously that's not Trevor's game. He attacked the story. He attacked the reporter. Major League Baseball has made very clear that it's looking at baseballs from a lot of pitchers. And I think they're basically just trying to see what exactly are we dealing with. And, you know, some of the older baseball fans may remember when the steroid era came out of hiding and all of a sudden became a huge issue. And before baseball ever adopted penalties for testing positive for steroids, they had a year where they just did testing with no penalties just to see how big a problem they had. And I think that's kind of what's going on now with baseballs. But because Trevor Bauer has been so outspoken about it, I'm sure it's very easy for somebody to say, hey, as long as you're checking some baseballs, might as well take some of Trevor Bauer's.
Now, that, Bill, that's a great point you make, because I had other people tell me that as well, is that this is a multi-step process here. And the first is letting the players or the pitchers know that you're serious about looking at the balls. That's the first thing. And it certainly doesn't hurt to publicly say that you're looking at the balls. And then you kind of let the players figure out, are they going to handle this themselves, or are they going to, you know, self-monitor it? And if not, eventually the commissioner's office maybe steps in. Got to ask you about the Padres and the Dodgers. A lot of us in the East Coast, you know this, a lot of us in the East Coast, they think of rivalries. They think of Red Sox, Yankees. I've always thought of the Giants and Dodgers as a rivalry. Is the Padres-Dodgers rivalry, has it surpassed Giants-Dodgers? Do you think this is the year it surpasses it? Or how would you rate those two? Because these are serious. Like, these are rivalries where fans sometimes beat the hell out of each other. So that, to me, determines whether or not it's a rivalry.
You know, I talked to a bunch of people with the Giants this spring for a story touching on that very issue. And I called the Giants people, actually set up some interviews, and said I was doing a story about the rivalry between the Dodgers and the Padres. And the person on the other end of the phone said, oh, that's cute. The Dodgers and Giants go all the way back to New York. It's 100 right. years. The Dodgers and the Giants were beating the hell out of each other in California before the Padres were ever born, which was in 1969. And the only three times when I went back and looked, so the Padres started in 69. The only three times the Padres and Dodgers have ever finished in the top two places in the National League West, they both went to the playoffs anyway. So there wasn't some big rivalry like, you know, one of these teams is going to knock the other out of the playoffs, or, you know, the great late season games where you'd have, if you grew up in California, you'd be listening to Vin Scully call the Dodgers in person and the Giants off the ticker and doing play-by-play of both games. And, you know, you had Mays, a Hall of Famer, Koufax, a Hall of Famer, you know, McCovey, Drysdale.
Marichal, eh?
Now you've got, you know, Blake Snell, who may or may not get into the sixth inning. So we'll see.
Bill, who, besides Tatis Jr., who is the most important position player for the Padres?
Well, of sheer talent, you'd say Manny Machado. I mean, it's not even close. Mm-hmm. But the guy that's really been interesting to me for San Diego has been Jake Cronenworth, who was obtained as, you know, a fairly anonymous player in a fairly anonymous trade with the Rays, who, of course, don't make mistakes, right, when they trade. Mm-hmm. But he's been sort of like what Kike Hernandez was, or Zach McKinstry is now for the Dodgers, a guy you can plug in all over the field, and he just hits, and he's terrific. And the other guy that really stands out to me this year for San Diego, and it's really two guys, so I'll throw them both in, Will Myers and Eric Hosmer. Because when the Padres first started spending money in this wave, first they gave Will Myers $80 million, then they gave Eric Hosmer $140 million, and a lot of people are like, why would you do that? You're not ready to win. But there was a time that was coming, and maybe sooner than a lot of people thought, that the Padres would be ready to win, and now they've got some veteran pieces who can actually be supplementary pieces. But now with, you know, Tatis hurt, Myers and Hosmer are the two best players statistically right now for the San Diego Padres.
In conversation with Bill Shaken on Baseball Central, how different was the mood? Well, understanding that because of the pandemic, access was restricted to players this year. But how different was the mood around the Dodgers, and is the mood around the Dodgers, Bill, as a result of them winning the World Series last year? Like, is there a sense that, not that the pressure's off, but is there a sense that we, you know, that as an organization, it's now about building your legacy? You know, the sort of the foundation's been established with that World Series win. Now let's build on it.
I think there's two things I would say. One is that when you don't have to answer the question anymore of when are you going to win the first World Series championship since 1988, you do have a burden lifted off. You know, it was great watching Kirk Gibson videos every night at Dodger Stadium, but they had almost become like the grainy black and white footage that your grandfather shows you. Like, we don't need to see that anymore. Let's move on. But the other thing is, when you ask, okay, well, where's the motivation now? Because you don't have to deal with that burden anymore. Dodgers say to a man, and Justin Turner said this most clearly of all, we didn't get a parade. So there's your motivation. We want to actually celebrate this year.
Okay, after this year, do you think, and this may be an unfair question to you, but if anybody's going to answer it, it's you. Do you think next year Corey Seager is the starting shortstop for the LA Dodgers?
That's a great question, and I know you're not going to want to hear anything other than yes or no, so I'm going to disappoint you, but it all depends on the market. You know, if you ask me yes or no right now, I'm going to say, well, what are the Dodgers' alternatives? Now, there was a time when Francisco Lindor was going to be out on the market this winter, and now he's not because the Mets signed him. You know, Carlos Correa is going to be out on the market, it looks like, but, you know, did the Dodgers want a guy who their fans are going to hate because he played for the Astros?
Right.
I don't know. But the other thing that I can't stress enough is the Dodgers don't ever believe that anybody is irreplaceable. They, as their farm system has showed, can find somebody to fill in at just about every position. And Gavin Lux came up as a shortstop, so they could play him there. They could sign somebody. Chris Taylor came up as a shortstop. I think they would like to keep Seager. They've been pretty public about that, but, you know, are they willing to beat every offer? You know, we'll find out. I mean, his agent is Scott Boras, who, as we all know, generally if you get to free agency, and some guys don't under Scott, but when you do get to free agency, Scott wants to take you deep into the winter and find the best deal. And, you know, there may come a point when the Dodgers say, look, you've had a chance to shop the market. Let's do a deal. And maybe he does, and maybe he doesn't. You know, and Justin Turner this winter, everybody knew that Justin Turner wanted to come back. So it was pretty much go test the market, see what you have, and then we can figure out something with the Dodgers. In Seager's case, I don't know that it's going to be quite that clear.
I want to talk to you a little bit about Fernando Mania, Fernando Valenzuela. Obviously a lot of writing this week about you know, Fernando Valenzuela 40 years later. He is now a Dodgers broadcaster along with the legendary Jaime Harin. I know Mike Petrello of MLB.com and other people, Bill, have written about Fernando in terms of his economic impact on the game. And I do remember, I'm old enough I can remember sort of vaguely, right, watching Fernando Valenzuela on TV. But it does seem to me that he was kind of, maybe I'm wrong here, but he was kind of the first player, the first superstar where you could say there was a measurable financial impact on the game, right? Attendance was noticeably higher when he pitched. I know in Montreal it was higher when he came in. I mean, he was much beloved in Montreal. Do people give Fernando Valenzuela enough credit for what he did in the game?
I think the people that grew up in Los Angeles and were there when Fernando Mania was a thing in the 80s, they all do. Because what he did is, number one, he helped the team win. I mean, his first full year was 1981. That's the year we commonly use for Fernando Mania, and the Dodgers won the World Series. But he also transformed a fan base, because the site where Dodger Stadium is built was used for housing primarily for Mexican-American families into the 1950s. And although the sheriffs had evicted most of those folks from that land and there was a plan to do something else with it, it sat barren until the Dodgers showed up and the city said, hey, why don't you use this site for your stadium? And the mythology has translated to the Dodgers kicked out the Mexicans, which isn't quite what happened. But there was definitely a hesitancy on the parts of some Mexican and other Latino fans in Southern California to embrace the Dodgers until Fernando came along. And all of a sudden, everybody loved Fernando.
Right.
But now it's gotten to the point that the Dodgers fan base, and this is years beyond when Fernando pitched for the Dodgers, because he was gone in, I believe, 1991. The Dodgers fan base is half Latino right now and very, very loyal. And that is all Fernando. And there's a huge debate in Los Angeles because the Dodgers policy has been, we don't retire your number unless you're inducted into the Hall of Fame. And in the meantime, the Dodgers do not give out Fernando's number 34.
Right.
So it's this weird passive aggressive thing. Like, we're not going to retire it, but we're not going to let anybody else wear it. And given what he's done for this franchise and for this city, it's really unfathomable. The Dodgers have not retired his number.
Bill, really good insight as always. Thanks so much for doing this. Stay safe. Be well.
All right. Take care, guys.
Thanks, take care. Bill. It's Bill Shaken of the LA Times. That's really good insight. And Bill, I mean, the Fernando Valenzuela story is intriguing because the Dodgers are widely heralded as being, of course, they were the team of Jackie Robinson, the Brooklyn Dodgers, but they're also widely heralded with being the team that opened up Latin America through their scouting, right? The Dominican Republic. I mean, they have a huge, they had a huge, huge imprint on Latin America.
Yeah.
But Bill's point is well made. There was, and there was a book written about this, and I'm drawing a blank. We had the author on Writer's Block. It's a really good book about the politics involved of the building of the Dodger Stadium at Chavez Ravine. But there was a reluctance because of the political history of Dodger Stadium for Mexican Americans in particular to kind of glom onto the team. And then Fernando came along, and it really did open. It opened an entire fan base, and by again, and he was. I mean, I wish we had, maybe somebody from Montreal can reach out, 590-590 is a text line. I remember, Fernando wasn't a thing, as much of a thing when I was covering baseball in Montreal, but I do remember people saying that he was almost as beloved in Montreal as he was in L.A. And Montreal has always had a thing for Latino baseball players. It always has.
He's a really good pitcher too, which never hurts.
Really good.
Yeah, to his point about Corey Seager.
Yes.
And who his agent is, and Scott Boras.
Yeah.
Is he as good as Lindor? He's a year younger than Lindor. If Corey Seager, let's say this, plays 145 games this year.
Yep.
Is he getting 10 at 341 or more? You're younger than Lindor.
Yeah, you know what? I hadn't even thought of that. I'm going to be God's honest truth. Would I give it to him? No, and I don't know why. I got to think about
baseball
it.
Baseball track record would tell you that most big deals don't work out. The Max Scherzer deal is the one deal that always.
Hey, Nolan Arenado with Colorado, man, that didn't look what happened there. I got to think about that. What did I say to you off air when we were talking about shortstops? I'd be all in Corey Seager. I'd probably take Corey Seager before I take Trevor Story.
But not at 10 at 342.
And I don't know why. I don't know why. Maybe I look at Corey Seager as a guy who could break down. I don't know.
You know Boras, that's what he's going to be asking.
Well, he should.
10 at 342.
He should. And Bill made an interesting point about Carlos Correa. I don't think Carlos Correa, I don't think he's going to be unemployed next year because of the Astros thing. But I'll tell you what. If you're the Yankees, let's say, for example, you want to bring a guy in with, you know, how much of a stain is left on the dude's reputation as a result of what happened with the Astros? Because unlike George Springer, you know, Carlos Correa was really obstinate and very, very upfront about that whole thing. Sure. He didn't necessarily fall on his sword as much as George Springer did. So I wonder, is there still, as Bill said, if you're the Dodgers now, you're going to bring a guy in that's connected to an Astros team that is not really highly thought of by your fan base? I mean, look, George Springer got his money this year. So obviously it didn't impact him.
Nope.
But I wonder. Does the market get eliminated because of that? That's a good point. But now, can I get back to you about Corey Seager next week? Because I got to think about Corey Seager 10 years. It's Baseball Central on Sportsnet 590, The Fan. All right, I got to remind you, you folks, you've got to follow Barker on Instagram because Barker's dad is cleaning out the place back in
Virginia. Yeah.
And he's found all sorts of Barker memorabilia, like cool stuff. The letter the Milwaukee Brewers sent you telling you that they'd
drafted. Don't tell them. Don't tell them because I'm going to do it the next couple of weeks.
The next couple of weeks, Barker's going to be sending the stuff out, and it's really cool. Like, I'm really glad your dad found this stuff because it's very cool. And this is stuff that guys who played in the game.
I wonder if teams that draft players now send a letter.
I don't know.
I have to ask somebody. I don't know the answer to
that. That letter was.
Yeah.
Okay. That's the only thing I'm going to reveal that you're good. That letter was
pretty cool.
That was pretty freaking cool.
It's been a long time since I've read that letter.
That letter was really something else. So, anyhow, follow Barker on Instagram, and you'll learn all sorts of hitting tips, fielding tips, and you'll get to see little snippets, including a great, great picture of the Barker family. Barker, you look cool in that picture. Now, that picture,
I look young.
You had the flip-down shades. That was good.
It was different.
That was good. That was good. You looked even more like
I don't think anybody wears those anymore because they're not cool.
I don't know.
I couldn't wear sunglasses in the infield because I couldn't tell how far away the ground ball was from me. So I had to use the flip down. That's me. Most people don't think that's cool enough looking.
Utility overlook.
Well, me, if I missed it, I was in AAA.
Yeah, well, there you go. You
had flip it.
Reasons to do it.
Flip it, grip it. I'm hitting my helmet, my hat until my hat falls off.
Flip it, grip it, and let me collect my paycheck. 4 minutes left before we bring Mr. Brunt in out of the bullpen. Steven Matz starts for the Jays tonight. One of the really good stories for the Jays this year. Now, he's got Kansas City. What's he going to have to do against that line?
Arm speed on the changeup is the one thing. You noticed yesterday Kansas City's real aggressive. They're getting after it. They want to hit the fastball. They want to be very aggressive early in counts. You know, obviously the glove side fastball to righties. That's a big deal. That's the obvious thing. But for me, I think the way you can do that is be real good with that side of the plate to righties. And also
Of the plate? Folks
on
the radio.
That's glove side to the catcher.
Yep.
I said that already.
All right, okay. And
that's into the righty away from the lefty. He's pretty good at that. But to add the arm speed on the changeup to go away from that, you know, you could go 0-0 changeup occasionally. And then sprinkle in some curveballs when he needs to, steal a strike, get ahead in the count with one of those get-me-over breaking balls. Point being is, mechanically, he's got to be sound enough to repeat the delivery and be all three pitches looking the same and be real good with the secondary pitches. Mm-hmm. That's the curveball and the changeup. If he can do that and also have a little bit of control with the four-seamer and to righties, I mean, that'd be great with it. You know, if he misses, miss and off the plate. Don't miss on the plate with it. He can give him six-plus innings.
What do the Jays have to do against Mr. Minor?
Hit the fastball. Like, I've said this till I'm blue in the face, and I'll continue to say it. You know, everybody complaining about the Vladdy pitch yesterday with the 1-1 pitch that was middle of the way. We all know umpires aren't any good. Get over it. Well, we know that. True. How about the 0-0-94 or 95 right down the middle to Vladdy? That's the one that you need to go back Lake City. That's a three-run homer. They win that game. It's those kind of at-bats that, you know, you need to refine a little bit more and have that simplified approach.
Mm-hmm.
Let's not overthink it. Just because a guy threw me this way in 2019, threw me two sliders and a breaking ball and struck me out swinging, don't mean I should walk to the plate and look for two sliders and a breaking ball, Jeff.
All righty. Well, there you go. We have got three games against the Kansas City Royals left. First pitch is at 8 o'clock tonight and Saturday, Sunday. Then the Boston Red Sox and then
four times in Blue Jays history that they're going to start four lefties in a row.
This is the fourth time?
First time.
That the
Blue Jays history that they've started four lefties in a row.
I don't know if that's good or.
It's the best you got.
Well, it's the best you got. That's.
Throw them if you got them.
Rafael Dolis is your closer. Yes? Or Tim Mesa? Mesa, Dolis, some sort of combination.
Rocky, how do you, getting in there. I mean, Dolis is probably the obvious choice. Who gets the highest leverage inning? Could be the seventh, could be the eighth.
Oh, God.
That's the question you got to ask yourself.
Not Tanner Roark.
He's off for a couple of days. You take a break. You got the last eight guys out.
I go with Dolis because he did it for me last year.
Yeah, he got a little run on his fastball now. He's got confidence in the split finger. You know, I like Barucci. You know, he can pound it in. Yeah. He can feed off that with the changeup and the slider cutter thing he's got working. Tim Mesa, not me. He's got the sixth inning. That's just
well, we'll find out. The Jays again. The injury bug has bitten.
Yeah.
Hopefully this is the last weekend. We don't see George Springer. Now, we're led to believe he won't be with the team in Boston. But then they go to Tampa. Tampa's near Dunedin, so maybe he's ready for that. We need George Springer.
Oh,
boy.
They need a 10-run game, and like, consistently.
Mr. Barker, thank you for doing this.
Happy weekend, everybody.